Chapter 23. I'm Prudenized. Every once in a while, it's a good idea to think about Korea, and not just on Korea Day. We fought a war there and lost 33,000 brave Americans. 50 years later, we still have 37,000 troops deployed on the Korean Peninsula, which might give you an inkling how long we could be occupying Iraq. Oh, and North Korea has nuclear weapons and has threatened to turn Seoul into a sea of fire. Still, let's remember some of the things Korea has given us. Sanyo, for example. Also, the Reverend Sun Myung-moon's Unification Church. The Reverend Moon has proclaimed himself, quote, the Savior, Messiah, and King of Kings of all humanity. Frankly, I don't think he's any of those things. But the folks over at the Washington Times do. They think he is the incarnation of himself, capital H, and agree with him when he says, I will conquer and subjugate the world. After all, he's their boss. That's why, since 1982, employees of the Times have been forced to marry other Times employees in mass weddings conducted by the Reverend Moon. This May, for example, Moon paired off the men in the subscription department with the women in classifieds and married them on the Times' five-color printing floor. The quotes are real. The Times' mass wedding is unconfirmed. So it's probably no surprise that the Times has not only reflected Moon's worldview, that is, I am the king of it, but doctored stories involving South Korea and those dealing with the Reverend's felony convictions for tax evasion. The Messiah spent time behind bars in Connecticut. Let's face it, you might be willing to alter wire service copy about a guy who has the power to force you to marry the gal in ad sales with a hump. Most of the doctoring, though, has not been about Moon or Korea, but about American politics. And much of that was done at the behest of the Times executive editor, Wesley Pruden. Pruden is an Arkansan whose father was chaplain of the White Citizens Council, an adjunct of the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, not the Korean King of Kings. I'm not sure what the chaplain does in the White Citizens Council. My guess would be that he provides comfort and religious counseling to troubled members after a particularly traumatizing assault on black people. According to Times writer and Blinded by the Right author David Brock, quote, there were endless controversies and resignations over what became known as Prudenizing news copy, slanting it in a conservative direction. Which brings me to 1999, the year I was Prudenized. That spring, I give a speech to the White House Photographers Association. It's one of those big Washington dinners like the White House Correspondents Association dinner, only not so prestigious. Sort of like the Polk is to the Peabody. I mean, come on, they're just photographers. So I'm doing my usual great job. Note, there is no reason ever to believe a comedian's self-report on how he went over. Nevertheless, I was killing. And I go into a bit about John McCain. A short sidebar about me and John McCain. I met John in 1996 when he gave a beautiful eulogy at the funeral of a mutual friend, David Ifshin, who died of cancer. Ifshin had been a Vietnam anti-war protester and in 1970 went to North Vietnam, sans Jane Fonda, where he denounced our involvement in the war on Radio Hanoi. David's denunciation was piped into the Hanoi Hilton, where McCain got to hear it in his tiny solitary cell. Ifshin had become a mainstream Democrat and is serving as counsel on the Mondale campaign. McCain, now a congressman from Arizona, angrily denounces Mondale for having Ifshin on his staff. Ifshin goes up to the Hill, marches into McCain's office, finds him and says, I owe you an apology. But McCain says, no, I owe you an apology. You had every right to do what you did. So they shake hands, become fast friends, and together with others, worked successfully toward normalization of relations between Vietnam and the United States. In his eulogy, John said that Ifshin had taught him to see the best in everyone. So I like John McCain. Anyway, I'm doing the White House Photographer's Dinner, and I go into my little McCain riff. Hey, I like John McCain, and I really think he's courageous. I mean, his stance on campaign finance reform and tobacco, wow, that takes guts. But this whole war hero thing, I don't get it. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, he sat out the war. I mean, anyone can get captured. Am I wrong? But isn't the idea to capture the other guy? Big laughs. It's called irony, and whatever TV, radio, and print correspondents may say, photographers love irony. The next day in the Washington Times, I read a column by John McCaslin, and he gives me the boo of the week. After several mocking references to Jews, Christians, and Christian doctrine, Mr. Franken scoffed at the war hero credentials of John McCain, who was shot down over North Vietnam, tortured, and held in mostly solitary confinement at the notorious hellhole called the Hanoi Hilton for more than 5 years. Anybody could get captured, Mr. Franken said, and waited in vain for laughs. But he kept trying. Essentially, he sat out the war. A few scattered boos. Well, isn't the idea to capture the other guys? I call McCaslin and I get him on the phone. That bit killed. Were you even in the same room? I ask indignantly. No, he says. Actually, he hadn't been at the event. What? Then how could you write that? I didn't. It turned out McCaslin hadn't even been aware that the boo of the week had been in his column. Wes Pruden probably added it, he said. Who? At this point in my life, I wasn't as up on the right-wing media as I am now. He's the editor. I'm pretty sure he was at the dinner last night. So the editor can add stuff to your column without your knowing it? Yeah, McCaslin said with just a twinge of resignation. It happens all the time. I'd never heard of such a thing. This editor had deliberately put my routine through the de-ironizer to make me, a Democrat, look unpatriotic and thereby serve his own sick political agenda. And he put it under a columnist byline without even consulting him. I had no idea what to do with this. A letter to the editor seemed kind of futile. So I sit on it, waiting for just the right time to lay open his scandalous breach of journalistic ethics. And 2 years later, I get my opportunity. I'm asked to be the keynote speaker at the American Society of Newspaper Editors. Maybe I think I can get the Washington Times expelled from the association. But I realized I was relying on just one source, McCaslin. To be fair, I at least had to check with the editor for his version of the story. What was his name again? I call the Washington Times and ask for their managing editor. I get a guy named Bill Giles. Giles tells me that there is no way that McCaslin's story is true. He's adamant. An editor would never insert something into a columnist's copy without consulting him. It would be a total violation of every journalistic tenet. Well, that threw me for a loop. So I call McCaslin, and he says, no, it wasn't the managing editor who inserted the copy. It was Wes Pruden, the executive editor. My next call is to Pruden, who answers his own phone. I tell him who I am, and I explain the situation, and ask him, do you ever insert copy into a column without consulting the columnist? A pause, then, yes, we do that. I thank Pruden and call back Giles. Yeah, I just talked to Wes Pruden. He confirmed McCaslin's story. You know that policy you said you had? Your paper evidently violates it all the time. There was silence on the other end of the line. Then, okay, thanks. That's good to know. One other thing I say. When do you plan to tender your resignation? Another beat of silence, then, thanks. Thanks for calling. So I went to the dinner and told the group the same story I just told you. There was sort of a collective shrug that said, yeah, that's the Washington Times. Chapter 24. Paul Gigot is unable to defend an incredibly stupid Wall Street Journal editorial. Sometimes you read something so stupid it just takes your breath away. You can't quite believe that someone actually wrote what's on the page. The effect is heightened when the source is, if not necessarily reliable, at least literate and usually capable of masking its distortions beneath a patina of institutional credibility borrowed from its news division. On February 3, 2003, the Wall Street Journal wrote an editorial so startlingly dumb that it may, in fact, be the single most idiotic piece of writing my 14 Harvard research assistants found during their many, many hours of labor, with the obvious exception of the entire Hannity book. Now, I don't want to bore you with the entire editorial. It starts reasonably enough, praising Attorney General Ashcroft for putting criminals who use guns while committing crimes behind bars. Their point, I gather, is that it's better to enforce gun laws than not to enforce them. Kudos. Then the editorial makes one slightly stupid point, as if to foreshadow the tsunami of stupidity that is to come. It cites increased prosecutions of federal gun crimes as evidence of Ashcroft's effectiveness against crime. The problem with this point is that prosecutions tend to go up whenever crime rates go up, which started happening the moment Bush took office. But this is just standard Wall Street Journal distortion. It's in the next paragraph of their editorial that things really get weird. The Journal charges that the Clinton administration, quote, spent its time devising new ways to keep average citizens from getting guns while leaving bad guys on the street. In other words, Clinton's crime policies, especially on gun violence, failed, and Ashcroft's were working. To clinch their case, they cite a statistic that they claim is an indictment of Clinton's approach and, quote, a vindication for Mr. Ashcroft. Are you ready for Mr. Dumb? Here he comes. The Journal writes, quote, in reality, gun violence has declined from 12% of violent crime in 1993 to 9% in the most recent justice statistics. Any gun control advocates out there care to apologize? Okay, listener, let's take a moment to test your political IQ. Who became president in 1993 when gun violence comprised 12% of violent crime? Was it George W. Bush? Or was it Bill Clinton? If you said Bill Clinton, give yourself a point. Now, the, quote, most recent justice statistics mentioned in the editorial come from the year 2001. Who ended his presidency in 2001? George W. Bush or Bill Clinton? Again, a point for Clinton. This next question is a two-pointer because it involves a logical induction. Here it is. If Clinton was president during the time when gun violence rates dropped, is that a vindication for George W. Bush's attorney general? Or is it a vindication for Clinton and his advocacy of gun control? The correct answer, well, do I really have to tell you? Now, add up your score. If you got 4 points, your political IQ is somewhere between 40 and 200. If you, like the editorial writers for the Wall Street Journal, got between 0 and 3 points, your political IQ is between 0 and 39. Dolphins are about a 36, but they're cute and friendly, too. I think Paul Gigot, who's edited the Wall Street Journal's editorial page since 2001, is kind of cute, or as he prefers, handsome. But as I learned when I called to ask about this editorial, he is not friendly. I left a message, and to his credit, Paul called me back. To his discredit, he refused to discuss the editorial. Even worse, he got angry and attacked me personally, impugning my motives. Quote, you just want to be able to say you called Paul Gigot and that he couldn't defend his editorial, so you can put it in your book to sell more copies, he said. Frankly, I was hurt. Nobody had ever spoken to me that way before. My actual intention was totally innocent. My purpose in calling Gigot was to discuss the editorial and, in a civil manner, find out why he chose to publish something so mind-blowingly asinine. I would have thought that he would have loved an opportunity to defend his work product against a mere comedian with only a passing knowledge of current events. Oh well. One unfortunate result of Gigot's intransigence was that he did not have the opportunity to address some other questions I had. Since the statistics cited in the editorial seemed to vindicate Clinton's gun control policy, I had taken the liberty of having Team Franken check out the Wall Street Journal's coverage of the Brady Bill debate. The Brady Bill, which passed in late 1993 and took effect in early 1994, required background checks and a 5-day waiting period for gun purchasers. As I suspected, the Journal opposed Brady and the assault weapons ban. But what I wanted to talk to Gigot about was the tone of the anti-gun control editorials. For example, in their January 26, 1994 piece, the Journal wrote, quote, an awful lot of innocent Americans have had to be robbed, beaten, stabbed, raped, tortured, and murdered to arrive at a point where a Bill Clinton could feel compelled to get tough on crime. I hope I'm not being overly partisan in suggesting that this was maybe just the slightest bit unfair to Clinton, who ran on an anti-crime platform, announced in his first State of the Union address his intention to put 100,000 more police on the street, and successfully fought to reduce crime every single year of his presidency. The Journal's December 10, 1993 editorial was no kinder to, quote, liberals in general. Quote, to date, their outrage over violent deaths has been a pose. Ouch. They nailed us there. I personally remember expressing mock outrage in 1993 over a brutal bludgeoning in Missouri that I had read about, but I was really just posturing to make it seem like I was a decent person with actual feelings for human beings. So what did the Journal editorial page say about gun control while it was still being debated? In May of 1994, the editorial page wrote, quote, "Democrats in Washington are bursting their buttons over two big contributions to the war on crime, enacting the Brady Bill and voting in the House recently for a ban on assault weapons. We're not impressed." They spent most of the editorial questioning the feasibility and constitutionality of Brady and pointing out that assault weapons are used in less than 1% of crime. Not violent crime, but crime, they said. Since roughly 43 million crimes were committed in 1993, this means that, using their logic, assault weapons were used in up to 43,000 crimes that year. Even assuming that in, say, half of those 40,000 crimes, the assault weapons were merely brandished and not fired, that's a lot of scary shit going down. Of course, their logic is wrong. Assault weapons were used in less than 1% of gun crimes. Then the Journal concluded with a challenge. Quote, "Democrats now think that with their bans, they have done something about crime. We hope someone will be keeping score on the results." Well, someone did keep score, and that score was presented in the Shit for Brains 2003 editorial. Quote, "Gun violence has declined from 12% of violent crime in 1993 to 9% in the most recent justice statistics." But let's take a more comprehensive look at Clinton's remarkable record on crime, using statistics from the FBI's Uniform Crime Reports. Violent crime had gone up nearly every year of the Reagan and Bush senior administrations. It went down every year during the Clinton administration, especially after his crime bill went into effect. To be fair to opponents of gun control, there were a lot of other things Clinton did to achieve this remarkable, un-Reagan-like drop in crime rates. He put more cops on the street. He instituted community policing. He aggressively enforced the Community Reinvestment Act, which requires banks to lend money to small businesses and homeowners in underserved communities. And, of course, he gave us the best economy in the history of the world. So Brady and the assault weapons ban were just a part of this incredible and unprecedented success in making America a safer and better place to live and raise our families. Okay, maybe that sounds a little partisan, so let's go back to that original imbecilic editorial to see who's really right here. You know, the great thing about our society is that we have a free press where different viewpoints can be expressed in a spirit of fearless inquiry. Sometimes, like in the case of the Journal and gun control, these opinions can prove to be badly, badly wrong. That happens. And no one would suggest that every editorial board has an obligation to admit when they've been wrong. Simply ignoring editorial mistakes is perfectly within the accepted practice of hack journalism. But when an editorial page goes out of its way to print facts that prove it completely wrong, and then claim that these statistics prove it completely right, well, that's not just bad, it's downright weird. In a way, this one little dumbass editorial is a microcosm of the Journal's editorial page. How much is stupidity? How much is dishonesty, and how much is the Journal just trusting that its readers' rabid ideological convictions will blind them to gaping holes in their reasoning? Hard to say. Can you imagine another field where you could get away with this level of sloppiness? Picture an ad agency pitching this SUV commercial. Video. Clips of SUVs tipping over. Announcer. The new Ford Explorer. Like all SUVs, impossible to tip over. Put your child in an Explorer today and see the results. Cut to shot of paralyzed child. If you were Ford, you'd fire that agency, wouldn't you? In conclusion, if I were Ford, I wouldn't hire the Wall Street Journal to make ads for any dangerous products I might want to foist upon an unsuspecting public. But that hasn't stopped the Bush administration from relying on the Journal to sell the public the most dangerous product of all: defective baby strollers that can collapse unexpectedly and crush a child. Also, tax cuts. Chapter 25. This was not a memorial to Paul Wellstone. a case study in right-wing lies. When I do my corporate speeches, I normally talk to groups that are anywhere from 60 to, 97% Republican. They know I'm a liberal, and they're normally aware that they're conservative, so sometimes they're a little nervous that I'll do jokes that make them uncomfortable or angry. Here's how I diffuse the situation. I say, as you can probably figure out from my book, Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot, I'm a liberal, and I know you're conservative, and that's okay. See, I've discovered that Democrats can't afford me. Huge laugh. They love this. It makes them feel rich. Then I say, so what I do is I make fun of you, you laugh, and then you pay me. Another huge laugh. Now I can say pretty much anything I want, and they'll just laugh and pay me. Everybody's happy. Democrats are a different story. Unlike corporate events, which, by the way, I love, you can book me on the web, I speak to Democrats for free. I try not to do it too often because, you know, a guy's got to eat. So I pick and choose. And the Democrat I did the most speaking for over the years was Paul Wellstone. Part of it was that I grew up in Minnesota, and Paul knew my folks. In Wellstone's first campaign for the Senate in 1990, my dad was part of a senior citizen theater troupe that did skits for Paul at nursing homes. That's pretty grassroots, don't you think? My dad died in 1993, and my mom went downhill pretty fast. They had been married for 51 years. She got depressed and about 4 years ago went into a severe psychotic depression, which brought with it an exciting element of paranoia. One night at the hospital, I went up to one of the nurses and said, excuse me, it's kind of awkward to ask this, but I feel out of loyalty to my mom that I should. Go ahead, she said. Yeah, what I was wondering is, are you pumping poisonous gas into my mom's room? And are you videotaping her? And are you not really a nurse, but actually an actress who is trying to kill my mom? No, said the kindly nurse. I didn't think so, but I felt I had to ask. Fortunately, the doctors pulled Mom out of it with some miracle drug, but she's never really been the same. The last time I saw Paul was in the late summer of 2002, about 6 weeks before he died in a plane crash. It was an evening event in the Twin Cities. Paul was in the middle of an intense, dead-even Senate race. He'd been targeted as vulnerable by the National Republican Party, and money was flowing in from around the country for his opponent, a suit named Norm Coleman. Paul was fighting for his political life. The first thing he asked me was, "How's your mom?" I told Paul I had just visited her. It was tough, I said. I couldn't even have a conversation with her. Paul nodded and said, you know, touch means so much. The next day, I took my mom out into the nursing home garden in her wheelchair. It was a beautiful day. I sat next to her for a couple of hours with my arm around her. I can't tell you whether it meant a thing to her, but it meant a lot to me. So that was Paul. Touch means so much wasn't the kind of thing you'd hear from a Michael Dukakis. I, along with innumerable people, loved Paul Wellstone for what he stood for what he fought for, and for who he was. I loved his wife Sheila, too. I don't think I ever saw Paul without Sheila by his side. Paul died on October 25th, 2002, when his plane went down in northern Minnesota. Sheila, his daughter Marcia, his driver Will McLaughlin, two other close aides, Tom Lapick, and Mary McAvoy, and two pilots died with him. 4 days later, C-SPAN, along with almost every Minnesota TV and radio station, carried a hastily put-together memorial service for Paul, Sheila, Marcia, Will, Tom, and Mary. I was there. It was a beautiful memorial, sometimes incredibly sad, sometimes funny, sometimes rowdy, and sometimes political. Some people watching on television were offended. Some people were moved. But the right saw an opening. They took moments out of context, lied about the rest, and used it as a political club to attack the Democrats. It won them the Senate in Minnesota and probably in Missouri, which means it gave Republicans control of the Senate. This chapter is a case study of how the right lies and viciously distorts. It is the story of how the right-wing media repeats its fabrications until they echo into the mainstream press. It is a story of pure cynicism in the pursuit of power. It is the story of how the lying liars took the deaths of my friends and invented a myth that changed the 2002 elections. And the best part is, it's hilarious. No, it's not. But listen anyway. You paid for this audiobook. The Wellstone-Coleman campaign had been considered one of the most negative in recent memory. Coleman had called Wellstone a joke. He told KSTP Radio on July 7, "I run against a guy who I quite often think is just the lowest common denominator. The lowest common denominator." Coleman said that Wellstone, quote, opposed any program that promised to move people from public assistance to private payrolls. Of course, that was a scurrilous lie. Paul's work in the Senate created jobs all over Minnesota. But mainly it was Coleman's proxies who played it dirty. The Republican Senate committee ran an ad called Pork that hit the hypocrisy jackpot. It savaged Wellstone for voting to, quote, spend thousands of dollars to control seaweed in Maui, claiming that he prioritized seaweed control over national defense. In fact, Wellstone did vote for S-1216, as did Strom Thurmond, Trent Lott, and 84 other senators. That bill did appropriate the seaweed control spending, but it also provided $21 billion for veterans' health care, $27 billion for veterans' compensation and pensions, and block grants to assist New York's recovery from 9/11. The National Republican Senate Committee was chaired that year by Bill Frist, who later replaced Lott as Senate Majority Leader. Before the memorial, Frist spoke with Wellstone's older son, David, who later recounted the conversation to me. "I'm sorry about your parents and your sister," Frist told David. "Did you authorize a seaweed ad against my dad?" David asked. "Yes," said Frist. "And did you vote for the seaweed bill?" There was a pause. They both knew the answer was yes. Finally, Frist said, "It wasn't personal." "My dad took it personal," David said. "Thanks for coming to my family's memorial." 4 days earlier, the Wellstone candidacy had ended with the plane crash. The Coleman campaign changed its tone, somewhat. According to a Minneapolis Star Tribune account of the 13 days between the plane crash and the election, Vin Weber, a former GOP congressman and a key Coleman strategist, started politicking mere moments after Wellstone's plane went down. Working a cell phone on his way to a meeting with Norm Coleman and the rest of the campaign brain trust, Vin tracked down his friends who had worked in John Ashcroft's 2000 campaign. He picked their brains about what to do when your opponent dies in a plane crash. What worked? What didn't? They told him that Ashcroft's decision to shut down his campaign and stay out of sight after the tragic death of his opponent, Mel Carnahan, had cost him the election. A key decision was reached at the meeting. Coleman would not repeat Ashcroft's mistake. Instead of disappearing, Coleman's post-crash strategy would be, according to the Star Tribune, to, quote, gravely and respectfully, but publicly, participate in the state's grieving process. The meeting ended at 2:30 p.m., about 4 hours after airport officials lost contact with Wellstone's plane. Sure enough, at 4:15 p.m., Coleman told a throng of reporters, quote, "I think our focus now is solely on bending our knees and being very reflective and very prayerful. I am giving no thought to anything other than the memory of Paul and Sheila Wellstone and the others on that plane." Coleman continued his new tactic by announcing that he was suspending his campaign until after Wellstone's funeral, and also by agreeing to appear that Sunday via satellite on ABC's This Week. After the show, he held what he called a non-press conference press conference. He was taking every possible opportunity to show voters that he was not exploiting Wellstone's death for political gain. The Wellstone campaign was reeling, but the Democrats needed someone on the ballot. Former Vice President Walter Mondale approved a leak to the press that he was highly likely to run, but he would not campaign until after a public memorial was held. On Monday, Coleman went on national TV again, conversing with Judy Woodruff on CNN's Inside Politics. She asked him whether his campaign was gearing up. His response was right on message. "If I ruled the world, Judy, we'd all still be on our knees and saying some prayers." The next guest was Harry Reid of Nevada, the number two Democrat in the Senate, who was unimpressed by Coleman's pieties. "Judy, Mr. Coleman is campaigning, and that's why he's on your program." He pointed out that Republicans had already started polling in Minnesota. Worse, they had dispatched Newt Gingrich, as a Coleman surrogate, to bash Mondale on NBC's Meet the Press. "I just think this is so classless," said Reid. Gingrich's attack on Mondale wasn't classless merely because it came so soon after Wellstone's death. It had the added classlessness of being a lie. Gingrich said, "Walter Mondale chaired a commission that was for the privatization of Social Security worldwide. He chaired a commission that was for raising the retirement age dramatically. If you want to raise your retirement age dramatically and privatize Social Security, Walter Mondale is a terrifically courageous guy to say that." Mondale hadn't actually chaired the commission. He co-chaired it. More importantly, he disagreed with the commission's conclusions. While the majority did support raising retirement ages and privatizing government retirement programs, Mondale co-wrote, or wrote, as Newt might say, the dissenting opinion. Had Gingrich searched on Google for Mondale and Social Security, the first hit would have been an August 20, 2001 article entitled, "Mondale Condemns Social Security Privatization." The lie had its intended effect. About the same time the Washington Post was exposing Newt's lie on its website, Judy Woodruff was credulously repeating it for a national audience on CNN. The Republicans say, Senator Reid, that they're simply pointing out Walter Mondale's policy positions, that he chaired this commission last year that came out with a report recommending the privatization of Social Security. The Wellstone Memorial was scheduled for Tuesday evening, October 29th, at Williams Arena. I flew to Minnesota and met up with my brother to visit our mom. We left for the event 3.5 hours early, but the arena parking lot was already full. When we finally got inside, the place was overflowing. 20,000 were packed into an arena meant for 16,000. The crowd at the event, which had been billed as a celebration of the lives of the deceased, had a raucous energy. From where I was sitting, it all seemed just incredibly natural and human, the way grieving people often jump between crying and laughing. A group of American Indians did some tribal drumming. A soul band called Sounds of Blackness played Love Train as dignitaries filed in. When the crowd saw Clinton on the Jumbotron, they went nuts. Same for Hillary, for Gore, and for Mondale, who was replacing Wellstone on the ballot. When Trent Lott's face appeared on the screen, a few people booed. It seemed like good-natured ribbing to me. Lott broke out in a grin and waved. The event lasted 3.5 hours. It opened with an ecumenical prayer led by the rabbi from the synagogue I went to as a child. Standing with the rabbi were dozens of clergy representing every religious tradition in the state. The first eulogy was delivered by a brother of Wellstone's driver, Will McLaughlin, and was one of the most beautiful I've ever heard. There were no celebrity speakers, even though many had offered. It was family, friends, and colleagues who each gave moving testimony to the lives of those who died. One of the 8 eulogies that night, given by Wellstone's best friend Rick Kahn, ended with a political call to arms that went over the top. The first part of the speech, though, was dead on. Kahn described how Wellstone had always said that it's not enough to believe in something if you don't act on it. Kahn exhorted the crowd to act on Wellstone's memory by standing up for those who lack the strength to stand up on their own. Everyone stood, which I thought was a very Minnesotan way to act. We're very literal. We cheered, too, with tremendous emotion. There was cheering and crying and stomping and applause all throughout the speech, even after Kahn's train left the rails. The trouble began when Kahn put maybe too fine a point on what the crowd had to do to keep Paul's legacy alive. "We can redeem the promise of his life if you help us win this election for Paul Wellstone." Huge cheers. He repeated variations of this several times, and the crowd stayed right with him. I could see how someone watching on TV might find this blatantly political battle cry just a bit too partisan for a memorial service. Then Kahn named a number of Republicans in the audience. Senator Domenici, Senator Brownback, Senator Lugar, Senator Hagel, and Senator DeWine, who are here tonight, are all Republicans for whom Paul had the utmost respect and whom he considered to be true friends. Cheers, prolonged, warm, appreciative applause as the crowd embraced the Republicans who had come to pay their respects. It seemed to me like things were back on track. But it turned out that Khan was going someplace I had never heard anyone go before. He said to the Republicans, "Can you not hear your friend calling you one last time to step forward on his behalf to keep his legacy alive and help us win this election for Paul Wellstone?" That was bizarre, I thought. You can't ask Republicans to stump for Mondale. Still, the crowd kept cheering. This was 3 hours into the event, and the emotion was just so intense that everyone was responding to everything. They had just cheered for Paul's friendship for the Republicans, and now they were cheering for the same Republicans to drop their own candidate like a hot rock. Khan ended his speech by repeating his final line 3 times. "We are going to win this election for Paul Wellstone." I looked at my brother, and he shrugged. George Latimer, former mayor of St. Paul and MC for the event, came back up and tried to do a little damage control by making a joke. "I was getting a little worried that the last speaker had a certain partisan tinge to his remarks," he said, "and I was glad that he concluded with that call for bipartisanship." Big laugh, but some people watching at home had a sour taste in their mouths. By one estimate, at least 630,000 people in Minnesota watched at least part of the memorial on TV. Reasonable people of goodwill were genuinely offended. And to people who only saw 10-second clips that were later repeated and repeated on TV, it looked like Khan and the crowd were just being foot-stompingly partisan, that Wellstone's death was being used for political gain. But Khan's speech was also full of phrases like, "Our hearts are now shattered, and tonight we are filled to overflowing with overwhelming grief and sorrow." This speech was coming from someone who was crushed by the deaths of his best friend, his best friend's wife, his best friend's daughter, and 3 other very close friends. Yeah, it had some inappropriate moments, but I assumed that people would understand and cut the man a little slack. Governor Jesse Ventura, who by then was deeply unpopular in Minnesota, had chewed gum through the first 3 hours of the memorial. After Khan's speech, Ventura walked out, saying he was offended. Now, Jesse the Body is not a man easily offended. In his 1999 autobiography, I Ain't Got Time to Bleed, Ventura proudly describes his visit to Nevada's Bunny Ranch, where he fornicated with what my feminist friends refer to as a sex worker. In fact, he proudly wrote that he made money off the deal by trading his belt made of machine gun shell casings to the sex worker for a trick and $10. "All the girls look like Playboy playmates," the Bunny Ranch website proudly quotes the Reform Party governor as saying. He denies actually saying this, and I tend to believe him. Ventura had no problem with the Bunny Ranch, but Khan's speech was beyond the pale. In fairness, Ventura never described any of the sex workers as being overly partisan. Maybe he really was offended by the memorial and not just showboating the way he had every other moment of his public life. So some people were offended and some people were moved. I thought the story was over. The best summary of it all was Joe Klein's piece in The New Yorker. "The memorial service for Senator Paul Wellstone, held last Tuesday evening in Williams Arena on the University of Minnesota campus, was overlong, excessively partisan, unpretentious, emotional, without being maudlin, and above all, egalitarian. In sum, an accurate reflection of the man being memorialized. There was none of the glitz and few of the easy tears that have come to mark such public events. The emotions unleashed by his death, the tributes from even his staunchest political opponents, are certainly a consequence of Wellstone's and his family's bracing, unvarnished humanity. But one senses there is also a more general mourning for the politics of larger themes and for politicians willing to discuss them. It is, in any case, stunning that the death of one man has occasioned the only breath of life we've seen this election year." That was pretty much the way I saw it, though a lot less eloquently. What I didn't realize was that between the raucous crowd, Khan's fiery speech, the imprimatur of independent outrage provided by Ventura's walkout, the memorial service had created a sort of perfect political storm for Republican opportunists. The morning after the memorial, I picked up the Minneapolis Star and Tribune and turned to the special section devoted to the event. It was titled One Last Rally, Victims Remembered with Cheers and Tears, with a heartbreaking picture of Paul and Sheila's granddaughter, Kari, crying. There were two stories on the front page. One was about the event itself. Overflow crowd pays tribute to Wellstone. The other was about GOP spin. Republicans decry service as political. With the story side by side, it was as if two different events had taken place. The real one and the lie one. Vin Weber was framing the Republican storyline. Quote, this was not a memorial to Paul Wellstone. This was a political event. Weber said the event was a, quote, complete, total, absolute sham, and accused the Democrats of, quote, exploiting Wellstone's memory totally, completely, and shamelessly for political gain. This seemed almost surreally dishonest. I flipped to the real story and read an excerpt from the eulogies, this one from Paul and Sheila's younger son, Mark. The one thing that comes to mind when I think about my dad is how proud he was of everyone around him and how he wanted to shed light on everybody's accomplishments. It was never about him. It was never about Paul Wellstone. It was about the ideal. It was about the dream he had. More than anything, I just have a message to my dad. The message to my dad is, Dad, we're okay. Dave and I are okay. The thousands and thousands of people that you left behind that care about you, we are okay. We will carry on. These are some of his favorite words that he ever spoke. Never separate the lives you live from the words you speak. That doesn't sound like a complete, total, absolute sham. In fact, it hardly sounds like a sham at all. That sounds like the kind of eulogy a father would love from his son. Hear that, Joe? When I called Vin Weber to research this chapter, I asked him whether he had watched the whole event and whether he had seen any of the eulogies. He said, yeah, there was some very nice stuff. This candid Vin was a refreshing break from the lying Vin who talked to the Star Tribune in 2002. But lying Vin had planted the storyline. The memorial was a total sham, a political charade. Going back to the lie story in the Star Tribune, I found a gem from a local Republican apparatchik. Republican political analyst and lobbyist Sarah Janicek said that what she found most outrageous were the screens inside Williams Arena prompting audience reaction, when to laugh, and how loudly to clap. Janicek was referring to the closed captioning that the memorial's organizers had thoughtfully provided for the hearing impaired. Janicek, perhaps, was thinking impaired, or more likely, honesty impaired. On radio, she said that the text on the jumbotrons was proof positive that the entire event had been scripted. She didn't mention that the words appeared on the screen about 5 seconds after they had been spoken. Janicek's insanely stupid and or viciously dishonest claim was repeated over and over on local right-wing talk radio. But what's a local lie when you can have a national lie? On C-SPAN's Washington Journal that morning, Kellyanne Fitzpatrick Conway, one of the Republican Party's most loyal flacks, picked up the jumbotron lie and gave it a little more pizzazz.
The Star Tribune covers the fact that the people who were in attendance were told by screen when to cheer and when to jeer. And they were told to cheer when the Clintons and Ted Kennedy were displayed, and they were told to jeer when Trent Lott and Rod Grams, former senator of Minnesota, who lost in 2000, were displayed.
The Republican lie machine was whirring up to speed. Driving to the airport, I happened to tune in to the Excellence in Broadcasting Network. I don't normally listen to Rush Limbaugh. I felt I paid my dues while researching Rush Limbaugh's big fat idiot. But I'd made a little bet with myself that I'd hear at least 3 lies before I reached the airport. I won the bet and had to give myself $10. Almost the entire 3-hour show was about the memorial. The first lie was sort of an overarching background lie. Rush claimed to be absolutely distraught about the appalling spectacle he had witnessed the night before. He was depressed, embarrassed, and feeling shame. He was near speechless because the whole thing had been a giant setup. Wellstone, whom Rush used to refer to as Senator Welfare, had been used for disgusting and ghoulish political ends. The whole thing had basically cheapened Wellstone's life. Limbaugh's entire 3-hour show was based on his fake sorrow about the total absence of decency on the left. Limbaugh's big lie, lie number 2, was that this was all a calculated plot by the National Democratic Party to win a Senate election.
They pulled a fast one over everybody,
Limbaugh blustered, pulling a fast one over his audience.
But this was not a memorial service for Paul Wellstone. It was not. And that's, to me, what's so sad about it.
Limbaugh was taking the high road, mourning Wellstone's death just like Coleman, and the Democrats were a bunch of craven political opportunists. A Democrat called in and asked if maybe there was a note of jealousy that 20,000 people had come to the memorial.
Oh, come on.
Rush responded dismissively.
They were bussed in by the AFL-C. I haven't even talked about the audience. Everybody knows it's a planted audience.
Wow. Ugly. Yes, there were some buses. Robert Richmond, who took care of all the logistics for the memorial, arranged for buses for the families of those who died in the crash. The families weren't a planted audience. Neither was the Apple Valley High School wrestling team, which came on its bus because Mark Wellstone, Paul's younger son, was their assistant coach. And yes, some unions chartered their own buses to the memorial. That's because Paul had been fighting for unions since long before he went into politics. When he was a young professor, he took his students to walk the picket line for striking Hormel meatpackers in Austin, Minnesota. Oh, and some veterans groups chartered their own buses as well, maybe because Paul wrote legislation to help homeless vets. By 4 o'clock, a full hour before the event, there were so many people at Williams Arena that Twin Cities Radio and TV had to tell people that if they hadn't already left their homes, there was no point in coming down. On top of the 20,000 in the main arena, there were 4,000 watching on screens in an adjacent gym, and thousands more standing outside watching an outdoor screen on a cold Minnesota evening. It was the largest spontaneous display of grief in memory in Minnesota. As Joe Klein wrote in The New Yorker, the most striking aspect of the evening was the crowd. He went on, "Such crowds, indeed crowds of any sort, have almost disappeared from American public life. Most political events, particularly in this election year, consist of a candidate, a microphone, and a few television cameras. Often there will be more people standing behind the candidate, police officers, veterans, students, anyone who might seem evocative or picturesque, than in front."
Everybody knows it was a planted audience.
It was as if Limbaugh and Republicans in general couldn't believe that people cared enough about a public servant and what he stood for to actually show up. And besides, spontaneous outpouring of grief didn't fit the picture Limbaugh was trying to paint. Back to my bet and lie number 3.
Wow, what an opportunity. Who was the first to come up with it?
Limbaugh mused to his 20 million listeners.
Okay, Wellstone's plane goes down, the news hits. Who was the first Democrat whose eyebrows went up and whose eyes lit up? Said, wow, what an opportunity we've got now. I was at McCullough for Clinton. Whose eyebrows went up and whose eyes lit up the soonest? And saw this as an opportunity, because somebody did. Somebody had to see this as an opportunity for last night to have even happened.
That's it, Rush. The old fallback, blame Clinton. That always works with your audience when you're trying to make something up. When I don't know something, I just tell a joke about Gingrich having a mistress. Rush, I know you have a 3-hour show every day that leaves precious little time for bothering to know what you're talking about, so let me tell you how it happened, and let me tell you how I found out. I called the people involved and asked them. Try it sometime. On Saturday, after David Wellstone had returned from the crash site, he met with Jeff Blodgett, Wellstone's campaign manager. David said that he and his brother wanted a small service for their parents and sister. but both realized the need for a larger public memorial. The family and staff had been deluged by condolence calls, impromptu prayer vigils, and crowds at the makeshift memorial wall outside Wellstone campaign headquarters. So, Rush, it was Paul's son David who first saw this as an opportunity to honor the depth of feeling for his parents, his sister, and their friends. They were under tremendous time constraints. It was now only 11 days before November 5th, and they felt it would have been unfair to Coleman to schedule the memorial too close to the election. They settled on Tuesday, October 29th. So he approached Anne Mulholland, whom he had worked with before she took time off to raise her three little kids, and asked her to give him 3 or 4 days to help plan the memorial. Anne had just accepted a new job at a nonprofit, but they agreed to let her start a little late. Anne told me what it was like when she went to work. The staff was a mess. They had lost not just their boss, their cause that they had been working for months, years, but their best friends. They were all grieving. I didn't want to make a noise. No one else was functioning. I took a cell phone to the bathroom and called my husband and told him, I don't know how these people are standing. Anytime I'd sit down at a desk, someone would start crying and tell me, that was Mary's desk. So I'd move and someone would start crying, that was Tom's desk. You have to understand that Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, these people were going to funerals. 6 people died. That was the overwhelming reality. 6 people, everyone equal. We asked each family to choose someone to do the eulogy. At no point did it ever cross anyone's mind to read the speeches. The day before, the people from the hearing impaired group asked, do you have any of the speeches? I just laughed. They wanted to type the speeches in for the closed captioning, but we just didn't have anything. On Monday night, our press guy said to me, oh my gosh, this is going to be on TV. Should we be thinking about something? By then, it was just kind of too late. So that was the huge Democratic Party's conspiracy to use Paul Wellstone's death to gain advantage in the upcoming election. Shame on you, Anne Mulholland. Rush said,
there was nothing sacred about this last night at all, unless the only thing sacred to those people was the advancement of their careers.
I don't know, Rush. I'm not sure Anne's nonprofit felt one way or the other about her involvement. Rush really got into the storyline that this was all a pre-planned, calculated power grab by the Democrats. He quoted Harry Reid saying that Gingrich's lying attack on Mondale had been classless. Rush took this one for a ride.
Senator Reid, you are the one to speak to classlessness. I mean, you obviously know it when you see it each time you get up and shave. For Harry Reid to talk about classlessness, knowing what he knew was coming, is illustrative of the sham that this whole thing last night was.
Knowing what he knew was coming. Sham. Planted audience. This was not a memorial service for Paul Wellstone. Disgusting. 20 million listeners. On November 23rd, 18 days after the election, Tim Russert interviewed Limbaugh on CNBC. Russert. Mark Penn, Bill Clinton's former pollster, said that 69% of Americans had heard about that memorial service before they voted all across the country. Limbaugh.
Oh, I gotta say something about that.
Russert. Go ahead. Limbaugh.
It was only broadcast on C-SPAN. How did they hear about it, Tim? CBS, ABC, Washington, there wasn't a whole lot of coverage of that in the mainstream press the next day.
Russert, talk radio? Limbaugh.
I think so. That's my point.
I don't know if Limbaugh can really take all the credit for the way coverage of Wellstone's memorial was cynically distorted for partisan political advantage, but the misinformation certainly reverberated into the mainstream. In fact, within hours of Rush's first broadcast about the memorial, CNN's Tucker Carlson was repeating and embellishing the story on Crossfire. The political world is still reeling tonight from yesterday's nauseating display in Minnesota, where a memorial service for the late Senator Wellstone was hijacked by partisan zealots and turned into a political rally. Republican friends of Senator Wellstone were booed and shouted down as they tried to speak. Tucker had clearly seen a different memorial than I had. By that, I don't mean he had a different perspective on the same memorial, because at my memorial, there was no open mic where friends could get up and reminisce about the dearly departed. No, the one I went to had a stage in the middle of a basketball arena with a pre-printed program listing all the speakers who had been chosen in advance by the families. What exactly had Tucker been talking about? I called him 6 months later and asked. "Did I say that?" he said. "Uh-huh," I grunted in affirmation. Tucker seemed genuinely embarrassed. "Gee, I try to always tell the truth because I know people are watching and can catch me." "No, Tucker," I assured him. "I know you tell the truth because it's the right thing to do." Tucker seemed genuinely perplexed. He told me he had a tape of the memorial that he had watched, and he couldn't understand how he had gotten it so wrong. Still, he wanted me to know, he had found the memorial very disturbing, especially Rick Kahn's speech. "Does it make any difference to you that he lost his best friend, his best friend's wife? I don't know if he was his best friend. I heard he wasn't his best friend." This was a wrinkle I hadn't come across. If Kahn wasn't Wellstone's best friend, but instead a cynical political operative, then maybe his speech really was just a shameless bid for votes rather than a misguided expression of raw pain. But then I thought back to the memorial, when George Latimer introduced Kahn with a quote from the acknowledgments in Wellstone's book, The Conscience of a Liberal. "Everyone should be blessed to have a friend like you. There is no one person outside my family that I admire and love so much." I wondered if Tucker had seen this on his tape of the memorial service. Tucker was still stumped about why he had said the thing about Republicans being shouted down as they tried to speak. He said he'd think about it and call me back. He didn't. A few weeks later, I bumped into Tucker, and he promised again that he would call. A few more weeks passed. Finally, I called him and left a message. To his credit, he called back, and together we figured out what had happened. It turned out that Tucker had gone on national TV October 30th and railed against Wellstone's memorial without actually having seen it. He didn't watch the tape until later that night in preparation for the next day's crossfire. Tucker didn't mention to his viewers that he hadn't seen the memorial. Instead, he said, "It makes me sick, and it is revolting." And Republican friends of Senator Wellstone were booed and shouted down as they tried to speak. And he said, "To politicize a man's tragic death is about as low as you can go, isn't it?" Yes, Tucker, it is. The Republicans fell in love with the whole lot booing thing. Peggy Noonan said on Hannity and Combs that 20,000 did it. The Star and Tribune called the boos a smattering. On the TV broadcast, they were almost inaudible. Mort Kondracki said on Fox that Norm Coleman was booed. He wasn't. In the Weekly Standard, Christopher Caldwell wrote that the crowd of 20,000 booed a succession of people who had come to pay their respects to a dead colleague, Senate Minority Leader Trent Lott, Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura, and former Minnesota Senators Rod Grams and Rudy Boschwitz. The St. Paul Pioneer Press said that muted boos greeted the arrival of Lott, the Senate Republican leader, and Ventura. Rudy Boschwitz was not booed. Yes, a couple hundred people booed Trent Lott. As the Star Tribune reported, quote, "Scattered boos greeted Senate Minority Leader Trent Lott, Republican Mississippi, as he entered the arena. Lott smiled and waved." I thought it was a good-natured booing, but maybe some or all of it wasn't. Who knows? Maybe he owed those people money. I know this. If Newt Gingrich had died in a plane crash in early 1995, and Clinton had gone to his memorial in Marietta, Georgia, he would have been shot. I ran this theory by George Stephanopoulos, and he said, yeah, and then they would have blamed him for coming. In fact, that's exactly what happened when Hillary Clinton was booed at the Madison Square Garden Memorial Concert honoring the police and firefighters who had died in 9/11. Most of the Republican talking heads who were distraught about the smattering of boos at Williams Arena were absolutely delighted by the deafening roar of jeers and taunts that silenced Hillary as she tried to introduce a film. "I think she got in large part what she deserved," said Sean Hannity. Rush Limbaugh was so distraught at the booing that he had the man who led it on his program as Dittohead Hero of the Day. Bill O'Reilly blamed Hillary for having the nerve to show up, considering that, quote, "Mrs. Clinton has not visited one family that has been affected by the terror. Not one. She did not go to one funeral. Of course, this wasn't true. Senator Clinton met with victims' families on 11 separate occasions between September 11th and when O'Reilly made this claim on November 15th. On September 15, Senator Clinton attended and spoke at the funeral service for Fire Chaplain Michael Judge, whom she had known. On October 6, she spoke at the funeral of a friend in Boston who had been on one of the planes that had struck the World Trade Center. Senator Clinton said she didn't attend other funerals because she didn't want to inject herself into someone else's private grief or cause a distraction, which is what she was accused of doing at the Madison Square Garden event. I made some more phone calls. First, to former Reagan speechwriter Peggy Noonan, whose op-ed piece in the October 30th Wall Street Journal took the form of a memo from Paul Wellstone up in heaven criticizing his own supporters for being filled with, quote, envy, poison, resentment, revenge, and hate. I wanted to know where Noonan had gotten the impression that 20,000 people had booed Trent Lott. She seemed very surprised to hear from me, but stayed on the phone long enough to make it clear to me that she had not actually seen Trent Lott get booed. When I told her that the boos were barely audible on the broadcast, she scoffed. I said, Peggy, I've studied the tape. I've seen it 50 times. Oh, Al, we all have, she said in that condescending, unctuous Peggy Noonan way. No, you haven't, I said. And you know why? Because no one replayed it, because you can't hear the booing. Oh, Al, Al. Tell you what, the whole memorial is on the internet. It's at http://shows.implex.tv/Wellstone/. Lott gets booed at 01:18:22. Do yourself a favor. Start about 2 minutes before that so you can hear what 20,000 people sound like when they cheer for President Clinton. Now listen to it yourself. Here's 20,000 people cheering President Clinton as his face comes on the Jumbotron. Here, listen to them cheer Hillary. Okay, now here's the moment where Trent Lott's face comes on the Jumbotron. Now listen. I kind of barely hear it, but that's not 20,000 people. So you might think that Peggy, 20,000 people Noonan, would have called back to apologize for her misrepresentation. And she did. No, she didn't. She's awful. Next call was to Christopher Caldwell, the Weekly Standard author of the 20,000 Boo to Succession of People quote. Caldwell wrote on behalf of the editors to give the official Weekly Standard take on the memorial. He said that viewers, quote, tuned in on television to watch a solemn commemoration and found a rally devoted to a politics that was twisted, pagan, childish, inhumane, and even totalitarian beyond their worst nightmares. He compared Khan's speech to, quote, a Maoist re-education camp, a sinister incident unexampled in recent American politics. He labeled the crowd a mob. He said that, quote, one of our major political parties, or at least a sizable wing of it, appeared to be dancing a jig on the grave of a particularly beloved fallen comrade. Most of those who watched this spectacle, Caldwell wrote authoritatively, felt disgust bordering on shame. Huh. Why do you say most of those instead of most of us? Probably a question of style. More bizarrely and libelously, Caldwell wrote, quote, the pilots and aides who died with him were barely treated at all. That was just crazy. There were long, beautiful eulogies about each of the aides. In fact, the speeches about Paul didn't start until nearly 3 hours into the broadcast. A friend who watched on TV told me, I was wondering when they would get to Paul already. Yes, my friend is Jewish. How could Caldwell have overlooked the first 3 hours? It was also puzzling. But then a question occurred to me. Tucker hadn't seen the memorial before he talked about it on national TV. Peggy, it seemed anyway, hadn't actually seen Trent Lott get booed. And as Team Franken was researching this chapter, the whole nastiness with Jason Blair hit the New York Times. Blair, as you will remember, was busted for making things up about events he hadn't actually seen. Could it be, I wondered, that Caldwell, writing on behalf of the editors of one of America's preeminent conservative journals, hadn't even seen the memorial? Caldwell called me back. I asked him about the pagan characterization. Had he seen the ecumenical prayer at the beginning? No. I asked him about the crowd of 20,000 booing. Had he seen that? No. How about the eulogies for the aides? Had he seen any of those? No. What did you see? I asked him. I saw it on TV. On TV? Did you see it live? No. Did you see a replay of it on C-SPAN? No, I hate to sound like I'm trying to get off the phone, but I'm on deadline. Oh, sorry. Well, thanks for calling back. Tell you what, when you need to get off, just tell me and we'll end it there for now. Okay. So, did you see a tape of it? No, I saw it on TV. On TV? What does that mean? I saw it on TV. So, you saw clips of it on TV shows? Yes. That's it. That's all you saw. Listen, I gotta go. I have two deadlines. Okay, thanks. Good luck with your deadlines. One last thing, though. Sure. Your magazine is called The Weekly Standard. Doesn't that mean you should have high standards? Actually, the standard refers to a flag or banner, you know, to rally around. Yeah, but I'll bet they come from the same root word. You're probably right, but I gotta go. Okay, thanks again. I'll call you. Sure. That's the last I heard from him. I called him the next day, and then every business day for the next 2 weeks. He must have been on a real crunch on a book or something. Clearly, Caldwell had written his entire piece based on the most damaging moments of the memorial, 5 to 10 second clips of Rick Kahn and the one political moment from Paul's son, Mark. Caldwell probably saw them on Fox, although the same clips were played on CNN and MSNBC. The right-wing storyline played to the mainstream media's biases of sensationalism, negativity, and laziness. Once the right wing had created its myth about what had happened, it became a lot easier to report the distortion than to report the truth. A journalist would just have to read a couple of op-ed pieces and watch the clips on TV, and he'd have his story. That's a lot easier than watching the tape of an emotionally wrenching 4-hour memorial service or talking to people who were actually there. Pretty soon, the story became the story. Predictions about the election noted the public reaction to the memorial myth rather than what happened at the memorial itself. The day before the election, Jeff Greenfield of CNN, one of the smartest and most thoughtful political commentators on the air, said, quote, "Republican senators who had come there were booed by the crowd. It was a crowd of thousands." When I called Jeff that day, he told me, "Al, the memorial backfired." If the Wellstone people, or worse, the Democratic Party, had tried to use the memorial for political gain, then yes, it could be said to have backfired. Greenfield had bought the spin. Jeff Blodgett told Minneapolis St. Paul magazine about how the Democrats' dastardly plan had backfired so badly. Quote, "We had already been to 5 funerals. We weren't thinking straight. If we had been preparing for a televised event that large numbers of voters would be watching, we would have scripted every minute. We would have known what every person was going to say." The ultimate irony, Wellstone field director Dan Kramer said, was that what would later be billed as a political event came about because we didn't think about it in political terms. It was the right, not the left, that tried to cheapen Paul Wellstone's life by dishonoring his death. It was the right-wing media, not the friends and families who spoke at the memorial or the people who came to it, that seized on an opportunity to use a tragedy for political gain. It was Rush and the Republican Party and the Weekly Standard and the Wall Street Journal and Fox. And then it was CNN and MSNBC and all the newspapers that wrote hundreds of articles that got it wrong. Some of them did it maliciously. Some of them just picked up the story. Some were evil. Some just lazy. Sometimes I wonder why people do what they do for a living and how they feel about their work. What is it about their work that gives them a sense of a job well done? As a comedian, I know I've done my job when people laugh. David Wellstone builds low-cost housing for the poor. I think he feels a real sense of accomplishment when a family can move into its own home for the first time. What do you suppose gives Rush Limbaugh that warm glow? Maybe it's when he gets into a real groove like he did that day after the Wellstone Memorial. Maybe it was when he said,
people took the occasion of his death and hijacked his soul last night and told us what was in it for their own personal gain. It was despicable, Paul. It was despicable. They wrenched Wellstone's soul right out of the grave, assumed it for themselves, and then used it for their own blatant, selfish political ambitions.
Or maybe it was when he said,
"What about the man who's dead and his wife and the people? It was their memory last night that was supposedly, and their work that was supposedly being heralded and remembered and memorialized. That didn't happen."
Or maybe he got that natural high when he said,
"Show me where the grief was. Where was the grief? Where were the tears? Where was the mourning? Where was the memorial serve? There wasn't any of this."
It would be kind of funny if that's what made Rush feel great, because it made me want to cry. I was remembering the eulogies and the lives of those who passed away. You've heard the right-wing story of what happened that night. Here's an excerpt from a eulogy by David McLaughlin. His younger brother Will was Wellstone's driver. Their late father, Mike McLaughlin, had been a well-known figure in state politics.
"We have dealt with loss before. Quite a few years ago, we lost our father, and it was a difficult time. But it was actually more of a celebration because so many people from our father's past came to share with us political battles won and lost. Some we should have won but lost, and some we should have lost but won because of my father. But really the most touching part of it is so many people, including George Latimer, who came up and had read about Dad in the paper and said, 'You know, I didn't know he'd accomplished so many things, because all he ever wanted to talk about was you kids.' When he went to work for the campaign, I think we were most proud of all. We did, however, have some concerns. William, being the youngest of 9 kids, had long ago made the decision he didn't much care for people telling him what to do or how to do things. And with his family, he had no qualms at all of telling us that. So we were genuinely concerned that here he went from being the big man on campus to, well, basically the driver and someone who needs to do what they're told. For people who have been in that role before, they said you often get blamed for things that aren't your fault, and you just have to shut up and take it. That was not one of William's strong suits. Funny thing is, Will and Paul really did work well together. And when others would try to give Will a different assignment, Paul would overrule them and say, 'No, Will's coming with me.' I really do believe that's why they became such great friends, is both of them wanted to do things their way and they wouldn't do what people told them. This is classic Will. Knowing him, he wouldn't settle for just doing a small job. He took it upon himself to be more than just the driver, to be the bodyguard, advisor, and the one who kept Paul going. Will's sense of humor was not lost in the seriousness of the campaign. Driving Paul around in Will's now famous black SUV, whenever they would see a car with a Wellstone bumper sticker on it, Paul would insist, 'Drive up next to him so I can wave.' And Paul..." So they'd pull up next to the car, and Paul would wave and wave and wave. Then he'd sit back in the seat and go, "Huh, they didn't wave back." And Will smile and say, "Huh." And this went on for a couple days as Will laughed to himself before he finally let the senator know the windows are tinted and they can't see. We all know that Will was having the time of his life. He loved having great success with all he did, and he really enjoyed the importance of being with the senator. But what most of us don't know is that what Will loved most about the job was he got to hear more stories about his dad. He truly loved being with Paul alone in the car, and Paul would tell Will stories of his dad's life he hadn't heard before. Even more fun is they'd meet people on the campaign trail who know both my mom and dad and the rest of the family and just tell great stories about them. That's what he really loved about the job. There are no words that any of us can come up with that would really justify Will's life, what he meant to us as a family and our friends and his fraternity brothers. So I'm going to share with you some of Will's own words from probably one of our proudest moments of him. When he was a senior in high school, just shortly after his father's death, he got up in front of the whole corps of cadets at St. Thomas Academy and did a very touching speech for us to see. Just as I have just a few moments to talk of Will's life, I'm going to share just a very small part of his speech. To my mother, you are the greatest. You have always been there for me. Now it is time for me to be there for you. I love you very much. Thank you for everything you have done. To the family, in the words of our father, you've done good. Many times in our lives, we take things, small and large, for granted. I always thought my father would be there for me when I needed him. He may not be there physically, but he will always be with me with the great memories we had. When I come home, I expect him to be there, but he is not. I guess in some ways I took him for granted by not thanking him all the time or saying I love you. Take a minute today to think of those things that might not be there tomorrow. I love my family and friends, and I leave you with no quote or words of wisdom to live by, just these simple words. I love my dad. William, we love you.